CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Sarah Ouster will be telling us a little bit about her accessibility work.
So, tell me a little bit about your work in the disability community.
Okay, so my name's Sarah Ouster, and I run the Sarah Ouster Services. Very clever, I know. But basically, I work with people with disabilities just to help them achieve their goals. I'm a behavioral specialist, respite worker, and I get clients from all ends of the spectrum, mental health issues, different disabilities, and we just kind of work together to achieve whatever goals they have. Kind of figure out life together, if you will.
So in that sense, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning things like mental health or invisible disabilities?
Oh, there are so many myths involving mental health. A big one that just stands out automatically is like mental health and, like, example, schizophrenia. Like, people are dangerous. People with mental health issues are maybe not to be trusted. Those are some big ones, but it's not true. That's something that is notorious for being perpetuated by the media. And there is a shift in the media that they're coming away from that. But early on in like the 80s, that was something that was perpetuated with people who had schizophrenia or DID, dissociative identity disorder, used to be called, multiple personality disorder. So it's nice that there's been like a paradigm shift with that. But it's kind of like when there's an idea about something, it is hard to change that. So people see schizophrenia, mental health, and automatically there's that stigma there. So it's hard to change that sometimes.
So how do you work with clients and those who would be there in their day-to-day lives to get around those misperceptions and those first-glance reactions?
Honestly, I think, I'm there to work with the individual. We're not there to change society's minds about individuals. We're there to work together to figure out what we have to do, right? And a lot of what I do is community involvement. A lot of individuals just want to go out and be a part of their community, whether that's make a friend or be able to just budget and go grocery shopping and stuff. And some of that, some of that's really tough if you have anxiety or if you have voices in your head that are like, you know what, no, stay inside, don't do anything. You don't need to eat, it's okay. So working through those anxieties, it's also tough if you go to the grocery store and then you get stares from other people, right? So trying to navigate those looks and just having a worker to be like, okay, how about we just focus on me? How about we focus on what's on the list? What's next on the list? And navigating those challenging situations as they come is kind of what we work through. Because with every situation, there's always going to be something, right? And a different way to handle it. But it's helpful when you have more than one person on your side versus going at it alone.
So one of the big things in disability life is building on momentum. How do you get that initial spark, that initial you can do this despite that you have your anxieties or voices in your head? How do you start off on that journey towards a better quality of life?
I think a lot of that starts with the client. It's those tiny building steps that come that you work on with the client, right? Like, example, reading. I have an individual who would like to get better at reading, so that's something that we've been doing the last couple of years. That was a goal that had originally come from him because he wanted to get better at playing video games, but was having a rough time with reading what was on the screen. So it was a small thing at first where it's like, I can't read the screen, so I just guess what we're doing. So we took that and we broke it down into some smaller steps and we started doing some reading every time we saw each other. So you take a big goal and you break it down into some like manageable, achievable steps. Because sometimes when you look at the big picture, it can be very, very overwhelming. But if you break it down into some smaller steps, it becomes a little bit more achievable. So over time, his reading started to really improve. But in the grand scheme of things, it was very overwhelming for him, and he would often quit playing. And that resulted in him not being able to participate with his online friends, and he would get very frustrated and quit what he was doing, right? So now he's in a place where he can keep up to the people playing the game and he can kill the bad guys. So that's something that he's very proud of. And it's also had a trickle-down effect where he can now read some billboards or all sorts of things that reading gives back to you. He can participate, but it started with, I just want to play my video games, right? So achievable goals and then broken down into smaller parts. But it has to come from the client. So I don't know if you've ever had a situation where somebody told you have to do something. But I know my initial response is always like, no, I'm not doing it. And it's not until I want to do it that it becomes successful.
So it's one of those things where it's motivation plus the overall strengthening in a person's life. I mean, intrinsic motivation is one thing, but if you find a skill like reading, you start to find that other areas of your life, you gain that confidence and that ability. It's almost becomes second nature to you. Do you find that to be a case?
No, I think you summarized it very well. That those skills build on each other, and then that leads to confidence, and then that confidence can then carry out through other parts of your life.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure thing.
Thanks. In this segment of our show, Mayor Mike Bradley will be giving us an update on the City of Sarnia's accessibility work. So what's the latest with the accessibility work in Sarnia?
Well, it's ongoing. It's a commitment to in the long term, not just the short term. Obviously, the last number of years with COVID and some of the significant issues with post-pandemic employment and dealing with the public have had made more of a challenge. But I also think that going through the pandemic proved that working from home, having people connecting through the internet, through Zoom, can give opportunities to people who have disabilities.
So that being said, with the rise in inflation, a lot of people are feeling the pinch. Do you find that there's a way for a person with a disability to really get ahead in terms of employment and actually have a sustainable income?
Well, it's difficult. And it's even more difficult for those who are simply on disability payments. They simply are not keeping track or connected to what inflation's all about. And the impact it has on someone's lifestyle and income is the inflation continues to increase and the devil's brew of inflation and interest rates as it relates to housing. So that has not made life easier for people. But there are some more opportunities, I think, out on the job front. But they've got to be livable wages that can give people an opportunity to move forward.
So are there any regulations or safeguards in place to make sure said wages are livable?
Well, I go back to what we've discussed before, and I've been a champion for many, many years, which if we had a guaranteed basic income and wiped out all the other social service payments out there, people would be in a much better place and would be spending that money back into their communities and improving their own living quarters and lifestyle and food choices, all those things. And we came so close in Ontario before the Ford government killed it to have pilot projects which would have shown, you know, the strengths of a guaranteed annual income and also what the flaws are and what needed to be fixed. But we went through that to some degree at the beginning of the pandemic, where Canadians were receiving payments without much checks and balances to them. And it showed you could help people, and there wasn't the type of issues I think some people thought would develop. But, you know, the reality is the present system is dysfunctional and doesn't work. And as inflation increases, that in turn makes it worse for people who are trying to survive on a very small, paltry sum to start with on disability.
So, do you have any advice for those out there who might want to take some positive steps to make sure that that they're in the best possible position?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, everyone has their own circumstances. I think what we need is more champions inside government to say, let's look at this guaranteed income again. Let's look at how we need to at least increase the rate of inflation, the payments being made to people who don't have any other options. I mean, that's the sad part about this. And their voices are pretty silent within the governments. You know, there's the normal stuff you go through with everyone talking about supporting people with disabilities. And look at the federal program. It's going to take another year or two to implement when it's been passed by Parliament and the Senate. That's just shameful. Just shameful.
So, have you seen any steps taken in the right direction in all this work?
Well, I see more people engaged. I think that's good. I think people are more sensitive to the issues related to disabilities and integration in the community and making a living wage in the community. I think too often people have focused on, when we talk disabilities, they talk on the physical issues and the infrastructure, which is important to give people access to employment and access to buildings, etc. But it's only one part of this. The real issue is jobs and employment. And when we have such a skilled trade shortage in Canada right now, we're missing that pool that can make a difference, that is there, educated, or willing to be educated, to be part of being employed and not just taking a government check, to be part of a growing workforce and getting a better life for themselves.
That being said, it's kind of interesting. If these workers were to go out and learn these sorts of skills, it would be an overall strengthening process, I think. Wouldn't just be something they would carry to work and wouldn't necessarily affect the rest of their lives as a person with a disability.
I think part of that is building self-esteem. You know, when you've struggled and you've been beaten down and you're trying to get back to a better place, it's often very difficult and very discouraging. So I think self-esteem, and I'm speaking to a major conference next week on accessibility issues, and they've asked me to focus my comments on the mental health aspects of what's been going on through COVID, post-pandemic, where the public is just grouchy and angry about the years they gave up. Well, they're not getting them back, so, you know, a more positive approach would help. But we're seeing that in every part of the workforce, that dealing with the public right now is extremely difficult. There's just an edge that is unfortunate for people that have to be on the front line trying to assist people in their lives.
So, that being said, if you could send any message to those in leadership about what needs to happen next, what would you say?
Well, it's the same message I've been giving for years, but we need the fierce urgency of now, that people shouldn't have to wait 2 years, 5 years, 10 years for access in a physical sense to buildings. We shouldn't have to wait all those years for employment opportunities. And that's the most discouraging part of this, is that that message doesn't seem to sink into government, besides the cosmetic stuff they do to announce they're doing this and doing that. But what has really changed? And that comes back to having a guaranteed annual income. It's having a guarantee to people to have an opportunity to succeed, not have to fight the system to do so.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
UWindsor Campus Police remind you to always be aware of building safety and security to help prevent theft and break-ins. Always keep track of your belongings and never leave them unattended, even for a minute. You should report suspicious behavior immediately to Campus Police at 519-253-3000, extension 1234. Examples include a stranger going from office to office, a person loitering for a long period of time, or somebody waiting outside of offices near closing time. Always stay aware of building safety and security on campus. UWindsor Campus Police is here to help you.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Sarah Ouster told us a little bit about her disabilities work through Sarah Ouster Services, and Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley gave us an update on his city's accessibility work. In this segment of our show, Karen Jones will be telling us a little bit about the Waha Warriors. So what can you tell me about the Warriors?
So the Waha Warriors began in, we actually debuted at ASH in 2020, and we represent patients who have warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia.
And that being said, how does this type of anemia typically affect a person?
So it's the destruction of red blood cells in a nutshell. And so the symptoms are usually fatigue is a big one. Fatigue, jaundice, sometimes a paleness, a heartbeat, those kinds of things, dizziness, things that, you know, you would typically expect when you don't have enough red blood cells.
So, with the similarities to so many other conditions there, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis or this being mistaken?
Oh, it's huge. And that is one of the challenges of having Waha, is the path to actually getting a diagnosis can be elusive. There is a test, it's called the Coombs test, that can diagnose the condition more readily. But that doesn't always come to the mind of our physicians who see our patients, sometimes in the emergency room and sometimes a GP.
So, do you have any advice for those out there who might be starting their journey and wondering, can I really keep myself motivated to get the proper diagnosis, get the information?
I think a lot of us would say, don't stop trying. You know, we talk a little bit about, in our group, we talk about finding a hematologist, or maybe it's a GP, that not only will listen maybe to your questions or ask you more questions, but really developing a relationship whether it's a GP or a hematologist. If we can't actually create those relationships, then we know that our care may or may not be what is really necessary for us to go into remission. And that is our goal when we are actively ill, is to find what will help us get into remission, long-term remission.
So how does the group reach out to the affected population to let them know that there is a support system?
So that is one of the biggest challenges with any rare disease is finding our patients. So we have a private Facebook group that is very active and very supportive of newly diagnosed and those who have been struggling for a while. We reach out to hematologists. We'll be at ASH, American Society of Hematology, this year as an exhibitor, actually. And we reach out to hematologists who see WAHA patients regularly and let them know that we are here for them.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected? You mentioned it's rare, so...
It's 1 to 3 out of 100,000.
Wow. So, in your time with WAHA Warriors, has there been any success story or time you were able to provide support that really stands out for you?
So I have to say, one of our biggest successes recently was in March. We had our first annual patient meeting for WAHA, and that was the first time that we've ever had WAHA patients and caregivers and hematologists and researchers all in one place. And that was really monumental for really everyone there, but specifically the patients and care partners, because we just had never had that opportunity. Like I said, our Facebook group is very active, and they connect very well. They discuss treatment. They really help newly diagnosed patients, and they talk about symptoms, all of that kind of thing. But to meet face to face is really just a huge door to open to even stronger relationships among patients and care partners. And our second one will be in March as well. March 1st through the 3rd in Nashville. And so we expect that we'll be able to find more WAHA patients to attend and, you know, bigger and better. I mean, the larger our organization grows, that means that we are serving more and more patients and care partners.
So one thing I've always found is when you're dealing with a rare condition of any sort, finding that first person who shares your journey kind of expands your world. Did you find this to be the case when the patients started connecting and realizing that I'm not the only one who's dealing with this? There are others out there who can be champions with me.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, we do. It is it's incredible to watch those connections be made. Because our patients sometimes have such a long journey to diagnosis, that once they actually get that diagnosis, and then they have a treatment plan, and then we are able to find them, or they're able to find us, and they find that it's that whole concept of I'm not alone. And so that is really profound among our patients. Yeah, so, and that, you know, with our group, that really is our number one goal, is to help patients find other patients, and to also, you know, be able to find the right treatment that is for them, and have a place that is private. It's private, and it's support, and it's camaraderie, and so we know that is just monumental to patients. And we do a lot with mental health resources for our patients as well, because they want it. They need mental health resources. It's just very difficult to go through a rare disease and struggle with diagnosis and struggle with treatment and all of those kinds of things.
So, do you have any thoughts as to how a patient newly diagnosed could keep from going to worst case scenario? Give themselves a little bit of a framework to keep an eye on the reality of this condition.
So, do you mean after diagnosis?
Yes.
Or, yes. I think it's always stay in contact. Always stay in contact, not just with the support group, like what, you know, what we are, but also with your hematologist. You know, it's difficult. There's a plethora of information about how one of the reasons why diagnosis is so difficult, especially when you have common symptoms like WAHA does. And it's really being persistent. It's finding that hematologist or GP who is willing to listen to your symptoms from your perspective in your lifestyle. You know, we always have a list of what's common, but really, if we don't have hematologists who look at us as individuals with individual journeys and lifestyles, then it sometimes falls short. So I would say it's just a matter of not giving up. Just don't, if something's not right, you know, reach out to a group, reach out to another hematologist, reach out to another GP, somebody that you can talk to. Many cases when we have our patients get together, they share such similarities, not only in their journey, but, you know, in the treatment and all of that. So it's very comforting.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure.
Sarah's point about learning to develop our skills, something we can all take to heart. But the fact is, disability life is as much about progress as anything else. Sure, we don't have an instant answer. We don't have the cure right in front of us. But if we take steps in that direction, sooner or later we will find our way. The truth is, disability life is predicated on the idea of thinking creatively. It's easy to tell someone what they can't do. What's not so easy is to live with that, to have someone else imposing that glass ceiling on us. It's just unethical, in my opinion. For you can't know what a person's heart and mind will allow them to do. If a person's motivated enough, driven enough, they will find a way. And in life, that's one of the most wonderful things, is being surprised. Seeing what we didn't think was possible realized before our eyes. Fact is, disability life is all about new ideas, new innovations. Today a person learns to read. Perhaps tomorrow they write the next great novel and inspire someone else to read it too. You can never underestimate, my friends, the impact that you might have on someone's life, whether that be for better or worse. If you get upset and you tell somebody they'll never achieve this or that, you don't want that to stick. In a moment of frustration, you don't want to tear down someone else's world. But you don't want, by the same token, to create false hope. You work with what is. You help someone reach their best. And there is no singular definition of what a person's best looks like. It's a question of what they want to achieve, who they are, and where they want to go. For any person with a disability, the hopes, dreams, and potentials are unique, just as much as anyone else in society. And the question before everyone else is, who are we going to be to that person? Are we going to be someone who stands at their side, or are we going to just accept that glass ceiling and say, this didn't work 20 years ago, so why should we try it again? Because we have learned, we have grown. People must keep open minds. That is the beginning of any disability progress. The more our minds are open, the more we can allow others to expand their horizons. So, I put it to you, my friends, the question is, who are you going to be? An advocate and ally? Or that someone who just says, we've done enough, it's good enough. But we must never rest on our laurels. Must always be willing to at least see if an idea works before we declare it impossible by our almighty authority to say, we know everything that can be done, which we clearly do not. But by standing with someone with a disability, we can see what they can do. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.